You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, there was a lot in the news over the weekend that provoked me to write things down and say, I got to share this with people on Monday. It's like I've got this long list of stuff that, you know, we're going to get through. Plus, in the second hour, Neil McCabe is going to come on. The NRA has now got a brand new conspiracy theory. This is entertaining. And our third hour, we're going to get into, when did happiness die in America? What happened to the American dream? And I'm guessing you can guess where I'm going with that, but this is good, maybe a little more of a little slightly different twist. But all of that pales in comparison to some of these. There's a couple of interesting, really interesting topics here that I wanted to get into. The first has to do with this great piece. Michael Tomasky wrote this, or Tomasky. I'm not sure how he pronounces it. I think it's Tomasky. For the Daily Beast, and it's titled, Why Obama's Haters Are Worse Than Bush's Haters. And he gets into how, and without quoting his piece at length, you know, let me just summarize it in my own words, because it was brilliant, and it was consistent with some things that I've said on this program in the past, and yet it was so concise, it really crystallized it for me, and I wanted to share this with you and give credit to Michael for this. What he's suggesting in this article, or what I got out of it, let me share this as this was the insight that I got. His article may be more nuanced or less, and it may be, you know, the point of it may be something somewhat different than what I'm characterizing. But essentially was that when conservatives talk about liberals or even Democrats like Obama, who is certainly no liberal, I mean, maybe he is deep down in his heart, but as president of the United States, he has behaved very much as a centrist, as a modern day centrist Democrat, which 60 years ago would have been a centrist Republican. And I don't mean that as a criticism. It's just this is how it is. You know, nobody can accuse Obama of being like a socialist. I mean, there's not even a public option in Obamacare, for example. And he's talked about being willing to, you know, put the chain CPI on Social Security rather than expanding the program. Social Security, one of the few programs that you could actually argue is socialist. So when conservatives characterize Democrats, they do it in the context of culture. Our way of life is under siege. That person thinks differently than we do, lives differently than we do, has a different set of values than we do, is the other. Now, this is characteristic, and Tomasky doesn't get into this at all in his article, but I'm going to add this. This is characteristic of movements, conservative movements, worldwide and throughout history. The uber-conservative movement of the fascists, for example, in Italy or Spain. I'm not going to even go to Germany because of the old saying about you lose the argument, but we can do this with others. The Pinochet, you know, taking over in Chile. Who is he killing? I mean, he was literally executing people, throwing people out of helicopters, killed so many people in the National Stadium. There are a lot of people who won't go to the soccer games in the National Stadium because they think it's desecrating the memories of the mass murders that Pinochet held there. Pinochet, of course, you know, did this military coup. By the way, Michel Bachelet in Chile, they pronounce the T. Michel Bachelet was just elected along with a large enough majority in the legislature in Chile that it looks like she's actually going to be able to get some good progressive left-wing stuff going in Chile. It's a big deal because the previous president was a conservative, and then the previous president before that was her. And she couldn't get anything done because because the parliament stalled her. So the people in Chile have said, okay, cool, bring it back. But I digress. When you look at the rationale that conservatives have historically used, whether it was Mussolini or Franco or Pinochet, or the conservatives who were blowing up churches and killing black kids in the South, the conservatives that made up the Ku Klux Klan, the conservatives that made up what used to be the Democratic Party back in the 30s, all the way back to the mid-1800s, or all throughout the 19th century, who promoted apartheid in the United States. Segregation now, segregation forever, right? It was a conservative position. I was a Democrat saying that, but he was a conservative Democrat, George Wallace and Lester Maddox. And those are the positions, you know, this was Nixon's whole Southern strategy was, you know, LBJ threw those guys off the Democratic Party bus by signing the Civil Rights Act, and so let's pick them up for the Republican Party, and they did. But anyhow, conservatives always frame the other side as being different culturally. Liberals, on the other hand, when they talk about the opposition, they don't talk about culture. They talk about politics. And this is his point about Obama's haters are worse than Bush's haters. Because when we, back during the Bush administration, we who disliked the Bush administration policies were criticizing Bush, we were not saying things like George Bush is, well, not all of us. I guess in some ways I was saying, you know, but by and large, the Bush was like, the next right winger, you know, he's taking us in a fascistic direction. But by and large, the Democratic critique of Bush was mostly, we don't like his policies. We don't like the war. We don't like his tax cuts for rich people. You know, very specific things. We don't like these policies. Whereas the conservative critique of Obama tends to be, the guy's a socialist, he's not really an American, where's his birth certificate, those kinds of things. And so I just thought that was really interesting, that liberals, by and large, are not wired to view conservatives as something other than being fully human brothers and sisters. In fact, it's wired into the liberal DNA. I mean, the closest I could get to this in my criticisms of Bush at my most extreme was to say that he's probably a sociopath. In other words, he's one of us, but he's like defective, damaged goods. Whereas the conservative critique of liberals is they're not even one of us. I thought this was really, really interesting. Okay, number one. Number two, this whole issue of companies, this is a great piece in the Washington Post, companies agreeing to buy back their shares or aggressively buying back their shares. What this is doing, companies buying back their shares, is it is driving inflation of the stock market. The stock market bubble is being driven in part by companies buying back their own shares. It also jacks up CEO salaries and takes money out of the economy. So, you know, Cisco just announced that they're buying back a huge, they're spending $15 billion. They only made $10 billion. They're spending $15 billion to buy back their shares. That's 2.5 times what they spent on R&D. And they just laid off 4,000 people. So not expanding their company, they're just making their stockholders richer, which includes their CEO and their senior executive.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Which is an argument to roll back the old Reagan policies, the policies that changed during the Reagan administration of allowing CEOs to be paid with stock. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. Andrew Campbell is on the line, our executive producer, our senior producer with the big picture. And Andrew, what's on the show tonight?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me. We're going to be starting off with Richard Wolff, and we're going to be talking to him about what transpired in Chile over the weekend. Chileans overwhelmingly elected the center-left leftist Michel Bachelet to the presidency. And we're going to tie that into how her election really shows how efforts to really build capitalism in Chile have failed.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, in fact, we pre-taped that earlier.
Yeah.
I know what he's going to say.
And we're also going to, you and Richard also talked about the growing protests in Italy over the devastating austerity measures that are going on there, just like they are in, right here in the U.S.
Yeah, this pitchfork movement.
Yep.
And then secondly, we're going to get into this. I'm going to debate Jack Berkman about whether or not it's time for higher wages for working people.
Yeah, there's a recent opinion piece put out by Anthony Orlando over on JuanCole.com, and it talks about how the 1% is hogging so much of our income that basically everyone else is screwed, and the economy really is screwed. It's just the inequality levels are so staggering that our economy is sluggish because the wealthy control a majority of the money in this country. So we'll be talking to Jack about that.
Right, and it's time to roll back the Reagan tax cuts and put working people back to work. And okay. Should Snowden get immunity?
Yeah, there was an interview on 60 Minutes last night, albeit a very whitewashed and very unchallenging interview. But one of the main news stories coming out of it is that multiple NSA officials that were interviewed said they are considering. It's by no means a done deal, and it's not even a consensus yet, but there are some officials considering giving Edward Snowden immunity and amnesty if he comes back to the U.S. and hands over all the files that he has. Not sure how members of Congress would feel about that. Not sure how even President Obama feels about that, but it's definitely an interesting news story coming out.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking to Shahid Batar from the Bill of Rights Defense Committee about that.
Great. And then Sarah Jaffe is going to talk about what tanked the Occupy movement.
Yeah, we're going to have some journalists on who have really covered and followed the Occupy movement since it began and have them talk about a new study/poll out that suggests that the real failure of the Occupy Wall Street movement and why it really collapses because of liberals' need to feel unique. It's definitely an interesting take, and Sarah and I think the other guests we're efforting are Jesse Greca and Jay Meyerson. They all have a lot of knowledge about the movement, so it should be interesting to see why they think it really didn't pan out.
Yeah. Huh. I have my own theories on this, which we'll get into tonight. And our Everything You Know Is Wrong, how powerful is the creationist movement, really?
Yeah, there's a new movement underway to insert creationism into homeschooling curriculum. And this, of course, comes on the heels of what Republican governors like Bobby Jindal down in Louisiana are doing, trying to put creationism in our schools. So what was really a marginalized movement some years ago is now becoming a lot more mainstream. We'll be talking about that.
And our daily take, when happiness died in America.
Yep, American dream is dead, and happiness is really hard to come by these days.
There you go. Andrew Campbell, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for dropping by. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Okay, so number one, conservatives view liberals as the other. Now, you know, maybe I was being too subtle. The biggest otherness that conservatives view President Obama as is black, right? That's why I was giving the examples of, you know, Strom Thurmond and George Wallace and all this stuff. I mean, that's a category that for haters, for conservatives, for people who view other people as not quite fully human or certainly not part of their community, clan, tribe, whatever, that's where racism lives. Right? I mean, that's very much where racism lives. One of the things that he links to, by the way, is a list of the 30 people that President Obama has killed. 33 unusual deaths connected to the Obama White House. Andrew Breitbart. Oh, Obama had him killed, huh? Steve Bridges, the Bush impersonator who offended Obama by also impersonating him using blackface makeup. It appeared he apparently died prematurely of unclear natural causes. I could go through the list. There's 33 of them here. And Donald Young, openly gay friend of Obama's, was murdered at Trinity Church in Chicago. He was a key witness in the Obama passport fraud case. Larry Bland and Nate Spencer were two other black members of the Trinity Church murdered at the same time. The report, mother of Obama's murdered gay lover, speaks up with video. Wow. Beverly Eckert died. She was a Continental Flight victim. She was a 9/11 widow. She was at the White House with Barack Obama, part of a meeting this president had with relatives of those killed in the 2001 attacks. Oh, so she had to be murdered. Michael Scott was killed, although Chicago School Board President Michael Scott's death has been ruled a suicide. Chicago police characterized the case as a death investigation, have not concluded that Scott's death was a suicide. He was subpoenaed to testify before a federal grand jury looking into the admissions practices of Chicago's elite schools. And was also under scrutiny with Olympics-related real estate dealings with Obama's chief advisor, Iranian-born Valerie Jarrett. Whoa. Valerie Jarrett was born in Iran? If that's true, good on her. Anyhow, it just goes on and on. I mean, it's like all this proof. I mean, this is like the Vince Foster stuff, you know? Hillary Clinton had Vince Foster killed when, you know, he had committed suicide. So, anyway, I think that there's a difference. The second, another one that I wanted to share with you, you'll recall back in, this was months ago. This was February 4th. So this was like at the beginning of the year. I did a long and extended rant based on this article that Gideon Rockman wrote in February of this year, 10 months ago. Called The Shadow of 1914 Falls Over the Pacific. And, you know, pointing out that World War I, we still don't know what caused World War I. I mean, we know that it started when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo, but nobody's really sure why World War I happened. You had the Britain was the greatest naval power. Germany had created the largest land army. They started developing a powerful navy, which was making the British very nervous. But the British and the Germans were having trade back and forth between each other. They were major trading partners with each other. So anyhow, Rockman, back in February, says the idea that the great powers of today could never again stumble into a war as they did in 1914 is far too complacent. And what he's talking about is the conflict between Japan and China, which has gotten much, much worse in the last few months, the last few weeks, actually. Keep in mind, this was 10 months ago he wrote this. They're fighting over these islands and disputed. Now China has made this airspace thing. And he said, the idea that great powers of today could never again stumble into a war as they did in 1914 is far too complacent. And he talks about how, you know, our agreement with Japan to defend them if they're attacked means that if China and Japan get into a war, that we're in a war, which means that instantly it's a world war. And then who's going to ally themselves with China? And this could spread really rapidly. Like, for example, if Iran allied themselves with China and then Saudi Arabia decided to declare war on Iran because they're friends of ours or whatever. Which, by the way, raises a whole another piece. But anyhow, the Washington Post yesterday, or day before yesterday, on the 14th, Saturday, published a piece by Simon Denyer and William Wan, essentially saying the same thing. The U.S. government has complaints, the title, U.S. complains to China after warships narrowly avoid collision. Actually, it's not saying the same thing. It's documenting something that is a piece of this. The U.S. government has complained to Chinese officials after one of its guided missile cruisers was forced to avoid a collision with a Chinese warship in international waters in the South China Sea. And then Margaret McMillan wrote a piece in the New York Times last Friday titled "A Great War's Ominous Echoes," in which Margaret McMillan says, you know, basically, that now is the time to think again about those dreadful lessons of a century ago. Like Wilson, at the end of the 1914-1918 war, Mr. Obama is dealing with a partisan and uncooperative Congress, similar to that of the British Prime Minister in 1914, Herbert Asquith, presiding over a country so divided internally that it's unwilling or unable to play an active and constructive role in the world. Key powers had weak, divided, or distracted leaders. Today, America's president faces a series of politicians in China who, like those in Germany a century ago, are deeply concerned that their nation must be taken seriously. All these parallels. And in the crash of 2016, I write about how the crashes are usually followed by a war. Now, my hope was that we had reversed the order. We had the war, Iraq and Afghanistan, and then we had the crash. And that's, and we're done with it. But maybe not, because it really wasn't a world war. Also, inside the Saudi 9/11 cover-up, Rupert Murdoch is talking about this now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The New York Post had this amazing article over the weekend. I will share that with you when we come back, and we'll pick up your phone. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 28 minutes before the hour. A federal judge, Josh Gerstein, reporting over in Politico, ruled Monday that the National Security Agency program, the NSA program, that collects metadata, in other words, it tracks, it doesn't, like, record your phone calls, but it keeps track of every single call you make or receive and how long that call is and to whom that call was made and that kind of stuff. A federal judge has ruled, Judge Richard Leon, U.S. District Court, has ruled that this is unconstitutional. Now, or he has ruled that there's a possibility that this is unconstitutional and put a stay, stopped the NSA from doing it. Then he put a stay on his own stay and said, yeah, you can continue doing it, but I'm still saying that you can't do it and pending my decision. If, am I describing this correctly, Shano? Is that a reasonable description? Okay. And meanwhile, he's going to make a decision. And if he decides that he agrees with himself that it's not constitutional, then this will get appealed to the D.C. Circuit Court, which we just had a second Obama appointee put on. It was a conservative court. It was a Republican-dominated court. It is now a Democrat appointee, Democratic appointee, dominated court, and there's two more appointees to come if Harry Reid does his job between now and Christmas. And so this could get really interesting. And the guy who did the lawsuit that won, in fact, we should get him back on the program. Larry's been on this program many times. Larry Klayman, Judicial Watch. Larry is a outspoken, hard right-wing guy. But, and he started Judicial, what's the name of his group down in Florida? Judicial Watch, I think, or Judicial something or other. In any case, he's the one who, Larry Klayman, who sued Dick Cheney about the energy meetings and got released the fact that Dick Cheney, in March of 2001, 8 months before 9/11, or 6 months before 9/11, Dick Cheney and a bunch of oil industry executives were meeting in the White House carving up the oil fields of Iraq. Now, this was before even 9/11, much less the invasion of Iraq. They literally had maps of Iraq, and they were identifying oil fields and potential oil fields and deciding which companies in which countries the oil would be sold to. And Larry Klayman, Judicial Watch, I'm pretty sure is the name of his group, published those on the Internet. They're widely available now. So Larry Klayman has a long history of going after the government, whether it's a Republican or a Democratic administration. And he's saying basically that collecting our metadata is a violation of our Fourth Amendment rights. Now, finally, inside the Saudi 9/11 cover-up, Paul Sperry writing in the New York Post, a newspaper owned by Rupert Murdoch. Front page story. President Bush inexplicably censored 28 pages of this 800-page report on 9/11. keep in mind, 15 out of the 19 hijackers were Saudi nationals. And Walter Jones and Stephen Lynch, members of Congress, one a Republican, the other Democrat. Walter Jones, Republican in North Carolina. Stephen Lynch, Democrat of Massachusetts, members of the House of Representatives, say that they have read the 28 pages that were kept out by the Bush administration that nobody could read. And they can't say what's in it, but they were shocked. And they have proposed that Congress pass a resolution asking the president to release these documents. But the New York Post says some information is already leaked. And now we're talking about who funded and facilitated 9/11. And they say, and the information that is leaked points back to Saudi Arabia. The Saudis deny any role in 9/11, but the CIA in one memo reportedly found, quote, incontrovertible evidence, end quote, that I'm reading from the Washington Post or the New York Post piece, that Saudi government officials, not just wealthy Saudi hardliners, but high-level diplomats and intelligence officers employed by the kingdom, helped the hijackers both financially and logistically. Now, if this is true, that means that 9/11 was not an act of terrorism. It was an act of war. That Saudi Arabia declared war on the United States. If they funded 9/11 and helped make it happen. And then they go through the actual examples. Saudi consulate official Fahad Al Thumari allegedly arranged for an advance team to receive two of the Saudi hijackers as they arrived at LAX in 2000. Bayoumi and another suspected Saudi agent, Osama Bassan, set up essentially forward operating bases in San Diego for the hijackers after leaving L.A. In Washington, then Saudi Ambassador Prince Bandar and his wife sent checks totaling some $130,000 to Bassan while he was handling the hijackers. This is Bandar Bush. This is the guy who spent so much time with George Bush that they started calling him Bandar Bush, Prince Bandar. And around the time that this investigation came out, Bandar all of a sudden went back to Saudi Arabia, apparently. One investigator said, our investigations contributed to the ambassador's departure, although Bandar Bush says he left for personal reasons. In Falls Church in 2001, Al-Laki and the San Diego hijackers turned up together again, this time at the Dar al-Hajira Islamic Center, Pentagon Area Mosque, built with funds from the Saudi embassy. Al-Laki fled the United States on a Saudi jet. The Saudi-sponsored cleric was briefly detained at JFK before being released in the custody of a Saudi representative in Herndon, Virginia, in Sarasota, Florida. I mean, they just have this whole long list. And you read it and you go, holy cow, it looks like Saudi Arabia actually, or at least government officials with the Saudi government, may have played some role in 9/11. And if so, and Bob Graham, by the way, the former Republican senator from Florida, was interviewed about this by The Real News, by Paul. What's Paul's last name? Anybody remember? Anyway, Paul, the Real News guy. And he just basically came right out and said, you know, this is pretty shocking stuff, and you guys need to look into this because it involves Saudi Arabia. So, anyway. That's my list of things I wanted to share with you for the day. I mean, there's lots of stuff in the news and whatnot we could talk about, but I promised you that we would pick up your calls, too. So let's do that. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Well, I tell you, you have to remember these few things when you talk about the haters of Obama,
mm-hmm.
President Obama. You have to remember that the modern-day Republican Party is made up of four legs. One leg is the Wall Street elitist. The second leg is the selfish libertarians. The third leg is the war hawks. And the fourth leg, which has turned into like the base that they all pander to, and that's the racists in America.
And then there's a fifth leg, which is the billionaires.
Well, that's the Wall Street elitist.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Those are the billionaires, and then, you know, the selfish Ron Paul type, and the war hawks, John McCain and Lindsey McCain, that want to blow up everything. And then you have the base, which is racist America.
Yeah.
And they all pander to this element. And there's no more reason other than this president is black that they've been able to build this hatred towards him. And they know that's all they have to do. You know for a fact, you're a political animal. You've been in this game a long time. You know that no president would be tolerated the disrespect. Now, that's one thing to play the political game. That's one thing. But for someone to stand up and yell out, "You lie," in a joint session of Congress and the House of Representatives, that guy would have been tarred and feathered in years past, whether it was a Republican or a Democrat.
Oh, and can you imagine if a black member of Congress had yelled that at a white president?
Oh my goodness! It would have been a scandal of all scandals.
Oh, it would have been the end of his career. I mean, beyond that, I mean, I agree with you. However, this is not a but it's an and. Remember what they did to Bill Clinton. I mean, they investigated him. 16, everything he did, basically every event in his life, whether it was losing $30,000 when he was 30 years old in a land investment in Whitewater, or whether it was his wife working at the Rose Law Firm, or whether it was his wife firing, doing basically what every new administration does, replacing the staff in the travel office with their political appointees instead of the previous president's political appointees. I mean, there was just a series of things that the Republicans kept saying were impeachable offenses. Darrell Issa is now, you know, Benghazi. Republican members of Congress who have come out and said that the Benghazi thing is an impeachable offense, that the IRS thing is an impeachable offense, that, you know, I don't recall any Democrats talking about impeaching George Bush over lying us into a war. Do you?
No, I don't. No, not at all. And I'll go with the Clinton thing. They were on Clinton. But it seemed like those things were akin to something.
What I'm saying is it's in the DNA of right-wingers. If somebody is a racist, that means that they are capable, that they're wired in such a way that they can view another person as not fully human. And so it's not just that they view people of other races as not fully human. They also view people of other political parties as not fully human. This is how, you know, Hitler didn't start with the Jews. He started with the communists, for example. And so that's my point. Carl, you made a very, very good point, though. Thank you for the call, and I'm sorry the music is cutting us off here. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, and you can drop into our live free chat room over at TomHartman.com. It's fun. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Tim in Lawton, Michigan. Hey, Tim, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, I got a really good idea, Tom. I thought when I win the lottery tomorrow, I'll go and buy two truckloads full of AR-15s and some ammo and then give them away to all the poor people in town, and then as long as they join the NRA. And that way, I could write it off as a charitable gift, and it wouldn't be a straw purchase because I'd be giving them away. And the NRA, I don't know why they don't do that themselves instead of paying lobbyists.
Well, because they want the rules changed, but they don't want poor people to have guns. I mean, this.
Oh, they don't.
No. Oh. The NRA is.
That's right. Adam Lanza was a rich guy, wasn't he?
That's right. Yeah. They're all about not, you know. I mean, they don't come out and say poor people and minorities should not have guns, but it's, you know,
but
there's.
This way, they wouldn't have to get one from some rich guy's cold, dead hand.
Well, I think one of the ways to blow up the NRA's whole narrative was if the shooters started, who's, you know, the people who are doing the shootings, if suddenly they started being called people of color, Hispanics, African Americans, you know, then maybe you would see a movement among white people for gun control. But as long as it's white people killing white people or killing other people, it ain't going to happen, which is the racism that infiltrates that movement. But interesting, you know, I realize this tongue in cheek. Interesting idea, Tim. Thanks for the call. Margaret in Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, Margaret. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
How are you doing, Tom?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Hey, I've been hearing all over Des Moines and in Burger King and different places here in Des Moines. I'm hearing that they want to impeach Obama.
Oh, yeah, they do. Yeah, they've been wanting to impeach him since the day after he was inaugurated. And, you know, Darrell Issa is doing his very best to try to find something worthy of impeaching him over. Thus, the Benghazi investigations. Now he's doing an Obamacare investigation. Before that, he was doing the IRS investigation. You know, he's like the Committee on Investigations or something. I don't know. But Darrell Issa is like, you know, he's the second richest guy in Congress, and he's in the House of Representatives, and he's really, really maybe the richest. And he's really working hard to try to find something that they can use to try to impeach Obama. I don't think they're going to pull it off. I think Obama is so squeaky clean. You know, they couldn't have impeached Clinton if he hadn't lied about sex.
Yep.
They finally found something. And I'm guessing that Obama is just, you know, his...
Yeah, I've been hearing he's still seeing her, too.
Who's still seeing whom?
That girl that he was having a love affair with.
Obama or Clinton?
Clinton.
Oh, yeah. I don't know that Clinton's still seeing Monica Lewinsky, but who knows?
You should see the tabloids.
Yeah. Okay. I haven't been keeping up on them. But Margaret, I can tell you with a high level of certainty that the Republicans are doing everything they can to figure out some way to have an impeachment scandal for Obama, because it'll distract Americans from the way that the Republicans and their rich buddies are robbing us blind and destroying our middle class. And that's why they went after Clinton. I mean, God forbid, he raised taxes on rich people. We can't have that. Margaret, thanks for the call. And that's interesting. It's all over Des Moines. I'll bet it's, you know, Republicans coming to town getting ready for the Iowa primaries in, what, 2.5 years? Year and a half, I guess I would say. Anyway, 10 minutes before you. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And as I was saying, let's pick up the phone calls. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank.
Hi. How are you doing?
Very well.
Thank you for taking my call. And I'm sorry to hear about your cat Higgins.
Oh, thank you.
I heard about that the week after he passed away.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of my cat.
Yeah. Well, that was the bad news. The good news is Louise has got a new kitten named Wolfie. So we're back to three cats again. And this little kitten is like, you know, he fits in one hand, but he just never stops. And he's just, so Louise is quite pleased. And so.
Yeah. It's both happy and sad that you can replay.
Yeah.
Because I have two. I had three.
Yeah.
Now I have two.
Yeah.
And, but anyway, let me.
Not what you called about.
What I called about, yeah. I heard a statement by, and I just got your book the other night, and I started reading.
Crash of 2016?
Crash of 2016, and I mean, I can't stop reading it.
Good.
But I'm trying to savor each point. But the thing that the book does is it reminds so many other things. And one of those is a quote by Leonard,
Lloyd Blankfein, the head of Goldman Sachs?
Exactly. Lloyd Blankfein. He said, quote, "We know how to create wealth, but we don't know how to distribute wealth," unquote.
Right.
And I thought, that sounds strange. It stuck in my mind, and it sounded strange, but I couldn't make sense out of it. Until I read your book. And on page 64 and 65, you started talking about the distribution of wealth by progressive income tax.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who make this money, you know, have to pay for what they do. So they have this, you know, for those listeners who don't read the book and especially pay attention to 64, this is how. So what I thought was, Lloyd Blankfein was really saying, we, the royal we,
right,
don't know how to, we know how to create what we don't. We do. So he is the government, or, he's saying that either he doesn't understand how the system works, either banks work with wealth and the government, you know, distributes, works on distributing wealth, or he's saying that we are the government.
Well, he's could be. It's an interesting speculation. I'm not. I'd have to go back and read the context for that quote, but that's a fascinating one. Frank, thank you for your kind words on the book, and thanks for raising that issue. Blank Fine is also the guy who said we're doing God's work, right? Just before the crash. Or maybe it was even just after the crash. Alan in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. Hey, Alan, what's up? Oh, Bob Graham was a Democrat. You're right.
Yeah, he was a Democrat, and the reason why he didn't run for the next term is it wasn't because he wouldn't get elected, because Florida loved him.
Yeah.
The problem was he was the head of the Intelligence Committee, and he knew all what was going on and didn't want to be a part of it.
Whoa.
That's why he didn't run.
Did he come out and say that, or is that your speculation?
Well, it was kind of my speculation and a few things I heard. I used to live in Florida, and I voted for the guy twice for governor and once for senator while I lived down there. So he was beloved by the people of Florida, and the people I talked to down there and everything had the same feeling that he knew too much. He wanted to say something but couldn't, so he figured that was his time to get out.
Wow.
In case it all went south, he wasn't going to be accused of anything.
Right. That's amazing.
You know, so now Feinstein's the head of it, and she does whatever they tell her to do.
It seems. It's hard to judge people who are in those kind of positions, you know, because on the one hand, they know what we know that they know, and on the other hand, they know what we don't know that they know. And I realize that sounds sort of like something out of the Fireside Theater, but there really are people who want to hurt us. And, you know, knowing that, what do you do about that, and how do you deal with it, and all that, you know, there's all these kind of existential questions that come out of it. But anyhow, Alan, thank you for the call. Stuart in Santa Monica. Hey, Stuart, you disagree?
I want to disagree with your stock buyback program.
You mean you want to disagree with my arguing that stock buybacks are a bad thing for the economy?
Yeah,
or what part of what I said do you want to disagree with?
Well, I think there are reasons you can agree with. And the reason is because of the Reaganomics and our trickle-down economics at this point. There is no demand in the economy. The
right.
Republicans are expressing that they want the trickle down.
Right.
They think that's going to work, but there is no demand for the products that these people are going to make.
Right, and in this article by Lin Yang, published in the Washington Post on December 15th, I'm assuming is a she. Writes, ultimately, analysts say when companies spend money on buybacks rather than investment, they're signaling low hopes for economic growth. And then the rise in share buybacks reflects a belief that a company's prime purpose is to return value to shareholders, even though that principle is not codified by U.S. law, U.S. statute.
Well, that's exactly right. There's no demand for their product. So they just have this cash sitting in bank accounts that are doing nothing for the economy. So at least by throwing this cash back out into the economy, it's doing something.
Well, it's except for the fact that, you know, 80 or 90% of the stock in the United States is held by the top 20% of Americans, and more than half of it is held by the top 1%. And those people are not taking this, as this money is being redistributed to shareholders. And yes, you're right, that's happening. Those shareholders, by and large, are not spending that money. They're putting it in savings accounts. It's going off to the Cook Islands or to Switzerland or wherever Mitt Romney keeps most of his cash. So, you know, and then they say, you know, big oil is plowing these profits into stock buybacks instead of increasing production, and executive pay is increasingly tied to movements in the stock and all that kind of stuff. So, Stuart, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Neil McCabe is on the line with us. Conservative commentator, editor of the Guns and Patriots newsletter. His website, Neil W. McCabe, MCCABE.com. And Neil, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom. Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. I have this article from Media Matters. I'm assuming you saw this.
Yes, I did.
NRA president pushes conspiracy theory that Obama will use Medicare to create a gun registry. Jim Porter has falsely claimed that Medicare enrollees are asked to disclose household gun ownership to revive the NRA's decade-old scare tactics about a federal gun registry. So, number one, is anything in this not factual?
I noticed throughout the whole article there's words like hyperbolic, baseless, falsely, and I think what it ignores.
You don't think the NRA is hyperbolic?
No, I don't. In fact, I think that they're, frankly, they're a little tame.
Cold, dead hands.
Well, those were the days, huh?
Yeah, I guess.
Those days aren't back yet. But,
oh, come on, Wayne LaPierre is still being paid $2 million a year to be the performer in chief.
Well, yes, but leaders of large organizations get paychecks. I think Media Matters. I don't think they're the Sisters of Mercy. Somebody over there gets paid, right?
Yeah, I doubt they're making $2 million, though.
Well, I would have to see that. But, I mean, David Brock, what do you think he pulls? Half a million?
You know, I have no idea. I doubt it's. I would be astounded if it was even close to half a million.
He's making over 100,000, though.
Who knows?
Moving on.
That's not the point. The point here is
$2 million doesn't mean.
The point is that he's outing the NRA for lying to their members.
No, Tom. You know, these registries, you know, it's got a lot of people concerned, and there are people who are
for no good reason. There's no not only is there no federal gun registry, but the last law that they passed actually, you know, it's in Obamacare, I think it is, that says that if you use this information for a gun registry and you are if you're a government employee and you use any of this information for a federal gun registry, you go to prison.
Right, but we also know that But we also know that government files get in the hands of people and nothing seems to happen to them. You remember that in 2010, the Washington Post had a four-man reporter team embedded with the Fast and Furious operation. They were given access to restricted ATF documents, which made it to the Washington Post.
Neil, if I wanted to put together a gun registry, a list of all the gun owners in America, all I'd have to do is walk over to the NRA headquarters and buy their mailing list for a buck a name.
Well, you know, there are people who
they
believe
sell
that
it.
Guns are a problem in this country.
No, I'm serious. The NRA sells their mailing list. They will sell it to anybody. They will sell it to me, presumably. I mean, I've never tried, but, you know, they make this, they, you know, most organizations sell their mailing lists.
Yeah, and I think that what concerns people is when you have the government having a registry or a database.
All the government has to do is buy the NRA's membership list.
Well, I don't want them to do that.
Well, tell them not to.
There are people legitimately concerned that there are political forces and political organizations that are looking to get rid of guns and collect them up. And you see these buyback programs in cities. There was a huge program back in the 80s to ban and 70s to ban handguns. I remember Harry Nielsen was leading it. I mean, so this isn't make believe. There are people who really want to collect the guns and get them.
The buyback programs are, you know, your dad died and you inherited his gun. Do you really want it? I mean, but the majority of the, or maybe it's not the majority, but my understanding is that the majority of guns that are acquired during buyback programs are guns that are not owned by people who want to be gun owners. They're owned by people who have inherited them or have, you know, have no longer have a need for them. They got it when they got out of the army.
They're motivated by the idea that guns are somehow a problem. That's why.
Well, guns are a problem.
Are they?
Yeah. You've got 36 people a day in the United States dying from gun violence. You've got a couple of hundred kids have died since Newtown. Yeah, guns are a huge problem in the United States, Neil.
Well,
and when Australia did a gun buyback program, it stopped their mass shootings.
Poison mushrooms are a problem. I mean, just because somebody's murdered.
Poison mushrooms are illegal. You can't sell poison mushrooms.
Well, you're not allowed to shoot and kill people either. That's against the law.
But that's different from owning a gun, where if you want to make that comparison, you have to make that comparison to eating poison mushrooms as opposed to buying or selling them. But here, let me take this a step further.
Go ahead.
I think not only that it's okay to have a gun registry, I think that's our salvation. I think that if we do not take cars away from people just because we have a car registry. Every state has a car registry. You own a car, it's registered. The VIN number, the vehicle identification number, and your name are tied together in the database of that state.
Sure.
And not only that, but you have to do two additional things if you want to take that car out in public, take it off your private property.
Yeah.
Number one, you have to have liability insurance, and number two, you have to demonstrate to the state, to your fellow citizens functionally, that you are competent at using it. And I think these three things should be in place for guns, that people should have liability insurance at the very least. I mean, I find it bizarre
in
Newtown.
I would encourage you to make that case to the American people and amend the Bill of Rights.
I don't see this as a violation of the Bill of Rights because it has nothing to do with militias. I'm willing to grant an exception for militias. If a militia has guns and if people are members of a militia, you know,
militia is every able-bodied male between, 15 and 60? Is that what you're calling the militia?
Well, we can define militia. Actually, I would say that the National Guards are our modern militias. But even beyond that, I don't see why having a gun, requiring people to register and license and ensure, you know, to license themselves if they're going to carry it off their property or use it off their property and insure it, the gun, if they're going to carry it or use it off their property. I don't see how that's inconsistent with the Second Amendment allowing ownership of guns.
Well, it's a restriction of freedoms, and you're pre-punishing people. You're restricting
their authority. It's not a punishment.
And
are you punished for owning a car?
Well, you're having to jump through hoops.
Well, it's not unreasonable. The reason that we
do something wrong.
Why do we have insurance? Why do we have liability insurance for cars, Neil?
I don't know why there's a presumption that something could go wrong.
Why do we have car insurance? Why does every state in the union require minimally liability insurance for car owners?
I think it has something to do with the hacks who run the insurance companies and the hacks who run the insurance regulators.
Now, you and I both know that's not true. It's because cars kill people.
Yes, but Tom, let's back up a minute.
I don't know of any liability insurance for loaves of bread.
What other constitutional rights do we need to register?
If you own a refrigerator, you don't have to insure it.
Fantastic.
But if you own a car, you do have to insure it because a car can kill somebody, and the only way you can kill somebody with a refrigerator is to drop it on their head.
Well, of course, you're assuming that I think the government should be involved in automobiles, and I'm not really there yet.
So you don't think that we should even be requiring liability insurance for cars?
No, I'm not really, not really.
So what happens when an uninsured driver kills your wife?
Well, I mean, there's a civil and there's a criminal process that is.
But what if that driver is broke and drunk and not even a U.S. citizen?
Presumably, you carried insurance, but this is but you decided to take that.
Don't you find it bizarre, Neil, that if Adam Lanza had been driving an SUV and had killed 20 kids, walking out of a school bus, the Geico would be given each one of them $1 million, but because he was carrying an AR-15 to kill them, the NRA is not paying them a penny?
Well, the NRA isn't going to pay them a penny. And don't you find it, you understand, Tom, that if somebody at that school had been armed, that incident conceivably would have been over.
Not true.
What do you mean not true? Of course it's true.
Well, you look at there have been other shootings where there were armed people.
That thing would have been shot
down.
There
were two people who were armed at Gabby Gifford's shooting. There were armed people at come on, Neil. There have been multiple cases of school shootings where there were armed guards, and
it's a Columbine where the police showed up and just waited for everyone to die. I mean, that's
Neil McCabe. Hang on just a second, Neil.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Neil, it's always good to have a rational conversation with you. NeilWMcCabe.com. Thank you, Neil.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Bye-bye. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And oh, Doug. Hang on, Doug. I want to get you a little bit later here. It'll be just a minute. L.A., watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Franklin, North Carolina. Hey, L.A., what's up?
Hey, just wanted to touch base and give you some insight into the peoplesbranch.org.
The peoplesbranch.org, what's that?
It's a political movement to allow the people to have a check and balance participation in government.
Check and balance of what sort? I mean, we have that right now. It's called elections.
And how's that working out, do you think?
Well, I think it's working rather badly, but not because we don't lack elections. It's working out rather badly because the Supreme Court has decided that money is protected under the First Amendment as speech, and that corporations are protected under the 14th Amendment as persons, both of which are totally bizarre doctrines.
Why is it, do you think, that the gatekeepers on both sides of the major parties really fear and hate the concept of giving the people a participatory right?
Well, the people, actually, the Democratic Party has been trying to expand the number of people who can vote. The Republican Party is the one that has been working very aggressively to reduce the number of people who can vote. And I think the reason why is because they know that the majority of Americans don't agree with their policies.
So voting, you think putting someone in there that doesn't really stick up and
well, the other half of this, L.A., you know, one half of it is you get to vote for somebody or vote against somebody. The other half of it is that in this democracy here in the United States, you can actually run for political office yourself, or you can join a political party and become a precinct committee person and decide, be one of the small number of people who decides who's going to be able to run in the primary and, you know, get your preferred candidates in there. You can help write the party platform. I mean, there's a lot of ways that you can insert yourself into the electoral process and the political process in the United States.
Well, I go back to the same concept. How's that working out? It's not working out.
Well, in a lot of parts of the country, I think it is working out. You know, San Francisco, for example, has not proportional representation. They have ranked voting, I think is what they call it. And it's working just fine, thank you very much. I mean, they ended up with a Green as their mayor for a while there.
Well, the political corruption is just run amok.
Well, I'd say the corporate corruption, the corporate corruption of our political process has run amok, yes. But that doesn't mean that you stop the political process. That doesn't mean you do away with the United States of America. It means that you restrain the corporations and the billionaires from being able to corrupt the government. And the one thing that's standing in the way of doing that is the Supreme Court. But what was the restraint that you were going to suggest? We're just about out of time here, L.A. What were you going to suggest?
Well, a people's branch would have some greater check and balance authority than just...
Well, that's what the House of Representatives is supposed to be. That's why they're elected every 2 years. They're the one that is responsive to the people. Whereas the Senate, because they're elected every 6 years, is supposed to be able to ignore the will of the people for at least 4 years, and then they have to respond to the people. I mean, that was the rationale in the early days. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Doug in Jamul, California. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Tom, man, you're hilarious today. I wish you would have said to that NRA guy that was just you were just having a conversation with that you should tell him that what you had, that you think that on your YouTube, where you think that the NRA should arm all black people. I would like to hear what he said in response to that. Why don't you ask him those type of questions?
That was not my suggestion. That was a caller's. But
I wanted to call. I called it a thing.
It was poor people, not black people.
You said black people. You said black. The NRA should arm black people because you thought there was going to be open season on black youth after the Trayvon Martin case.
When Doug, you're making stuff up.
The caller. Open season on white people with a knockout operation, all the violence, blacks against whites. The exact opposite happened. So you should, you know, why don't you say that to that NRA guy and let him respond to that nonsense?
Doug, you're not making any sense.
Because I'm making this truth. I'm giving you a true statement on your own account. Now, listen, I got to thank you for you caused me pain. $150 a month I have to pay now if I want to keep my doctor because of Obamacare, thanks to you and your supporters of Obamacare. So that's $1,800 more a month, a year, I mean. $1,800
more. So you're buying your health insurance now on the exchange?
I tried, but can I explain myself? Give me a minute to explain it.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm in California, and I'm currently on TRICARE, but my wife is on Kaiser, which she pays $343 a month currently.
Right.
To get Obamacare, the cheapest plan on the exchange is $849 a month.
Why don't you keep Kaiser?
$849 a month.
Keep Kaiser.
Wait. You're not letting me say that's the cheapest plan. But because of Obamacare, my doctor, since 2007, right, is now going into this called what other doctors are going to do, call them wellness plan, which means they're going to take, instead of seeing 5,000 patients a year because of Obamacare, they're going to go down to 600 patients to pay into this membership that they will only see.
Okay, so your doctor is basically becoming a concierge doctor. What does that have to do with anything that has to do with Obamacare?
Directly, Obamacare, she had this conversation with me. She doesn't want to take care of 5,000 new patients.
No, I understand that. And, in fact, the doctor that I see here in Washington, D.C. is a concierge doctor because that was the only, literally, the only doctor I could find when we moved to Washington, D.C. that would see me within 8 months. There were no doctors in the city that I could make an appointment in less than 8 months. And so, you know, Louise and I pay an annual fee to have a doctor, but she doesn't take insurance. And this is a growing trend across the United States. This was years before Obamacare.
But this is getting more popular now.
It is. Of course it is. It's getting more popular because you've got physicians. I don't know that it's how much more popular it's getting, but in high income areas, it's getting more popular because you've got physicians who are saying, hey, there's people here who could afford to do this with me. I mean, here in Washington, D.C., we've got the richest zip code in the country, just, you know, is the county north of us and in Virginia. And D.C. itself has become so gentrified. I mean, we've got 30,000 lobbyists here. The starting pay for lobbyists is a couple hundred thousand bucks a year. And if you're a congressman or senator, it can be millions. And so the doctors in this town increasingly are saying, yeah, I'm not going to take insurance. I'm only going to see, you know, 500 patients, and I'll charge them $1 a year, you know, or $1,000 a year. And so I got my $500,000 a year covered, and that's it.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's the end.
I'm not criticizing it. I'm, you know, welcome to free enterprise. What it does, in my opinion, is, you know, the problem here, it has nothing to do with Obamacare and has nothing to do with concierge medicine. It has to do with the fact that the American Medical Association limits the number of people who can graduate from medical schools. We should do what they do in every other developed country in the world, and we should say nobody can control the supply of doctors. You can't say only 40,000 people a year can graduate from medical school or whatever the number is. You can't do that any longer. And so if there's a lot of people who are qualified for medical school and there's medical schools that want to open, and even and you know, make money or whatever, you know, providing a good medical education and graduating a lot more MDs. Let's do it. Your beef, Doug, is not with Obama. It's not with Obamacare, and it's not even with concierge medicine. Your beef is with the American Medical Association.
No, this happened because directly responsible from Obamacare. She told me. So my doctor lying to me? She was making this up?
Well, if there were more doctors to compete in the marketplace, don't you think the price would go down?
Absolutely. And what does California do? California restricts the number of nurse practitioners. Nurse practitioners.
See, I don't think that I don't think any state and I should be restricting the number of nurse practitioners, the number of doctors, the number of physicians' assistants, the number of naturopaths, all that stuff. Everybody should be free to become a physician or get into medicine if they want. And I'm telling you, Doug, by Obamacare expanding the universe of people who have access to a doctor by another 30, 40 million people, there's going to be so much pressure that you're already seeing this. You're going to start seeing nurse practitioners and physicians assistants getting additional powers in states, the ability to do things that they couldn't do before, like prescribe medications and do minor surgeries, at number one. And number two, you're going to start seeing pressure for the MA to block their, you know, to break up their stranglehold on the number of doctors who can graduate. And three, I'm guessing that probably DOs, the osteopathic colleges, like at Michigan State University, you're going to see more of those things. And, you know, 5-10 years down the road, we're going to look back and go, okay, this was a turning point. We went through a period of some dislocation, and I'm with you. This is a period of instability. And what came out of that was better medicine for the United States, less expensive medicine for the United States, and more widely available medicine for the United States. So, Doug, you know, I'm sorry to hear that your doctor has decided to become like my doctor, but, you know, stuff happens in life. Can't just, you know, force everybody to do what they always did. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Has Obamacare hurt or helped you? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very bombastically ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good, Robert Reich. During an appearance on ABC's This Week yesterday, the economist and former Clinton administration labor secretary blasted Republicans for blocking every attempt by President Obama to do anything about America's ongoing poverty problem.
5 years of President Barack Obama, we see the problem worse.
Well, the problem is worse. I think it has something to do, perhaps, with the intransigence of the Speaker's party. Because every time there was a jobs bill, every time there was an effort to expand low-income housing, every time there was an effort to provide better opportunities for young people, we're talking about equal opportunity.
There you go. And when Reich's fellow guest, former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, tried to blame Democrats for poverty in America, Reich fought back, pointing out that inequality is a problem everywhere.
What's happening
it is
in America?
True. A lot of these public.
We've had a Democrat in New York for 20 years.
What's happening in America is happening all over America, and it is happening in a way that has to do with the fact that wages, median wages, are going nowhere,
right,
and rents are going up, and there is absolutely no response in Washington or elsewhere, particularly. Newt, I'm surprised you are not.
All right, we are unfortunate.
Indeed, as usual, Secretary Reich is right on the money. Good to see him calling out Speaker Gingrich's lies, too. The bad. Matt Schultz, Iowa's Republican Secretary of State, has spent $150,000 over the past year and a half investigating, you guessed it, voter fraud. Although Schultz says that voter fraud is a big problem, his much-vaunted ballot security initiative has yet to find any concrete evidence of mass voter fraud. Five people charged with voter fraud have actually had their cases dismissed. And of the five who have pleaded guilty, most broke the law by accident. As Raw Story reported, one woman, Beth Ann Gallagher, cast an absentee ballot on behalf of her daughter, who had recently moved to Minnesota and thought she wouldn't be eligible to vote there. However, after she mailed the ballot, her daughter texted her that she had been had been eligible to vote, at which time Gallagher self-reported the incident to the Delaware County Auditor's Office. Earth to Republicans. Widespread voter fraud just does not exist. Shame on Secretary Schultz for perpetuating the myth that it does. And the very, very ugly Bob Rucho. The Republican North Carolina state senator is under fire today for an anti-Obamacare tweet he sent out on Sunday morning, referencing the Supreme Court's June 2012 decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate. Rucho said, "Justice Roberts, Penn, and Obamacare has done more damage to the U.S. than the sword of the Nazis, Soviets, and terrorists combined." That's right. Bob Rucho thinks that Obamacare, an attempt to give people access to affordable health care, is worse than the Nazis. The fact that anyone would even consider making that comparison is very, very, very ugly. It's mind-bogglingly ugly. Larry in Olympia Fields, Illinois. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hello.
Hey, Larry.
Hello.
Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, well, I enjoy your program, Tom. I was calling because I was listening to you talk about the conservatives and how they are, you know, kind of culture warriors. And I was thinking, you know, basically that sort of fits in with the idea that, you know, they want the rewards of society to basically fall to the wealthy and to the people who are already, installed and in place, and don't like the idea that, you know, we might have to share, you know, with others. And the Democrats, of course, have a broader base idea of who should, you know, be in on the goodies. And, you know, the Democrats' point of view is obviously threatening to the powers that be, and Republicans don't want to see that go down the drain. So they appeal to people's conservative natures and fears of losing what they already have, including their guns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got a kick out of the guy that was on before who said, you know, what can go wrong? Why do we have to license guns?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty funny. Anyway,
yeah.
I'm mixing a few things together there. Sorry.
No, that's fine. So that was your point. That was
my point.
Okay, I think it's well made, Larry. I still think that this issue of Democrats debate issues and Republicans debate culture is something that progressive messengers and the Democratic Party has to come to terms with. I think the Democratic Party and progressives need to start talking culture and not necessarily demagoguing culture the way that Republicans do, but talking culture. And this is something that the religious left has been talking about for a long time, is, hey, acknowledge that we're here. And I think that, you know, frankly, I think guns, for example, provides a space for that. Although my suggestion is more policy based. Again, you know, let's license and insure and you've got to have and register guns. But that's policy. Whereas the right wing is, you know, oh, you want to deprive us of our right to defend ourselves or that sort of thing, which is not policy. It's more culture. I'm still trying to figure out how to change, you know, what do we do with that kind of messaging? But anyhow, Larry, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Cliff in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff, what's up?
Happy holidays, Tom. Much love to you and your family.
Well, thank you. Back at you, Cliff.
Including your cats.
Yeah, and the new one. Yeah, Wolfie.
Real quick, before I get my short rant in, I now refer to the Republican Party as the party of poverty. You know, with the cutting of food stamps by billions and opposing the hike to minimum wage, you know, what else can you call them, you know?
Well, they're certainly the party that has caused a lot of poverty in the United States.
And they don't want to do anything about it. I don't see any evidence of that. Anyways, USA is number one, Tom. We're number one. We're number one in the world in military spending. We're number one in the world in arms sales, selling weapons of death around the world. We're number one in the amount of citizens locked up in prisons and penitentiaries and jails. We're number one in student loan debt, and we're close to number one in wealth inequality.
And we're number one in the number of citizens killed by guns.
Yeah, and on the flip side, we're, what, number 22nd to 32 in the world in math, science, and reading skills, you know, the educational categories that are our investment in the future. I mean, what does that say about our priorities as a country? I mean, how do we reverse this terrible trend?
Yeah. No, it's I'm totally with you, Cliff. It's an absolute screaming disaster. Thank you for the call. Ryan in Oswego, Illinois. Hey, Ryan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just had a really selfish question really quickly. I'm writing a song on revolution. I was wondering if I could just get three words that you may use in that kind of revolve around revolution.
Wow. Hope, change. I mean, you know, the thing that you find is that revolution happens in countries not when conditions become intolerable, but when expectations are separated from reality rapidly. And so, you know, people, if they expect to have miserable lives, they will not revolt, and they have miserable lives. But if people expect to have good lives and they have miserable lives, they will revolt. It's called the J curve. There's a whole science to this. And the divergence has to reach a certain point. And before there's revolution, whether it's armed revolution or simply political revolution. And so that disconnect between expectation and reality is that's the kernel that's always at the heart of every revolution. And so I would guess that if you wanted to sing about that, you would want to go back to that. You know, if there's a Phil Oakes song that comes to mind. Dee, 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 dee. I can't remember the words, though. It's. I'm sorry, Ryan. I don't have three magic words for you.
No, you fulfilled my needs. I just have one more thing. Have you heard of a hip hop artist by the name of Immortal Technique?
No, I've not.
Okay, well, if you have some time, check out Immortal Technique. I think that you would enjoy some of his words.
Great. I will do it. Thanks a lot, Ryan, for the call. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was going to go back and talk. You had a guest on who was talking about gun rights and so on. And I have to tell you, I'm getting tired of being bullied by the gun rights people about the Second Amendment and how it was intended. What it was intended to say and so on, or what it was intended to mean. But I wanted to point this out, that the Bill of Rights, because he said you got to amend the Second Amendment. And I thought, to say what? The Bill of Rights was not intended to apply to the states. And I got, of course, a couple of Supreme Court cases to back me up. You might want to write them down and check them out for yourself. The first one, which declared this, was Barron versus Baltimore in 1833. John Marshall said that John Barron, who was the plaintiff, did not have the right for compensation in eminent domain as per the Fifth Amendment, because it was the city of Baltimore that was dumping dirt into his harbor and made it useless for mooring boats, which is how he made his living. It was not the federal government.
That has to have been changed since then.
Well,
the case in Connecticut that caused. What was the Supreme Court justice who has retired? It was Kelo. What? Yeah, David Souter. That caused David Souter to, you know, essentially resign from the court and retire back to New Hampshire, and then they tried to seize his house. Okay, what was the other one, Paul? Quickly.
Well, of course, the 14th Amendment superseded that case, but the court ignored the 14th Amendment three times. In the slaughterhouse cases in 1873, Cruikshank versus the United States in 1876, and in Gitlo versus New York in 1825. It was only in 1954 in the Brown versus Board of Education.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
5 seconds. It was only in Brown v. Board.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Paul. Thank you. Thank you for that. Paul's our resident constitutional scholar. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jim in Concord, North Carolina. Hey, Jim, you are a school teacher?
Yes, I am, Tom. And I wanted to comment about the guy who was on about the gun rights. Mm-hmm. And he said that if somebody at Sandy Hook would have had a gun, maybe that thing wouldn't have happened. Well, for the week right after Sandy Hook, we had a resource officer, a police officer, patrolling up and down the halls of our middle school. And I stopped him one day and I said, okay, if Adam Lanza comes here or somebody like Adam Lanza comes here, can you stop him? He looked at me and he smiled and he says, Jim, I'm going to have to get really, really lucky. because chances are it's I'm not going to help. So the point is that that guy, when he says just another gun in the play in that school in Newtown would have stopped it, when you have a trained police officer saying probably not,
yeah,
it throws the theory right out the window that more guns will help the situation.
Yeah, unless you have, like, you know, 20 Mutant Ninja Turtle style cops surrounding the building with SWAT rifles at all times. And yeah, I'm with you. Jim, thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Concord, North Carolina on the Dish Network. I appreciate it. Kathy, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network in Valparaiso, Indiana. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
Great. What's on your mind?
Okay, first of all, I got to ask you, how come you're not showing us pictures of the new baby?
Oh, the kitten? I've got it here. That's a good, I'll have to take a picture and bring it in and throw it up on
okay.
the screen. Yeah.
Well, the other reason I called you was because I tried to explain to the young lady that answers the phone, things are so depressing out there. I'm trying to find things to make us feel a little better. And this was what I had to tell you today. There was a woman who complained to her friend that her neighbor was a poor housekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
Reminds me of the Republicans. I don't know if you've ever heard this or not. She goes on to say, you see how dirty her house is? It's almost a disgrace to be living in the same neighborhood. It just looks, just look at those clothes she has hung out on the line. Look at those black streaks on the sheets and the towels. The friend walked up to the window and said, I think that the clothes are quite clean, my dear. The streaks are on your window. I thought you needed a little something to laugh about. Cause
yeah.
This is basically what's going on in society. I call it kindergarten. They're acting like a bunch of kindergartners.
Yeah.
And it's driving me nuts.
Yeah. This is...
So thanks for your show.
You're welcome. Thank you, Kathy. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Jerry in Galway, New York. Jerry, we have a minute to the break.
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I just wanted to call up. There's a thing that happened. That guy from the NRA that was talking,
mm-hmm.
and he seems to have not remembered that there are words in the Constitution that says a well-regulated militia.
Yeah, I thought about that after I got off the phone with Neil, that the word regulated only appears in the Second Amendment. It's like... I mean, the regulations appears in the Constitution, but the regulated only appears in the Second Amendment. And so, yeah, if we're going to talk about licensing and registering and insuring guns, it seems to me like that's regulated, right? That's well regulated. That would be a good thing according to the Second Amendment. Excellent point, Jerry. Thank you for calling and making it. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give the gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. And Victoria, welcome.
Hey, Tom, it sounds like you may have the news.
How's that?
Did I hear rumors of a kitten?
Oh, yes. Louise got a kitten.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. Yeah.
Picture, please.
Yeah. Okay. We'll send it. We'll send you one.
Yes, please.
He's small and gray and has stripes and he's just the cutest little thing. He fits in one hand, you know. So.
A silver tabby. Yes. Pictures, please.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Now we've got the big news out of the way. We can move on to lesser matters, such as federal judge ruled today against the National Security Agency's collection of phone records, saying that the program, which collects information on nearly all phone calls made to, from, or within the United States, almost certainly does violate the Constitution.
Now, yes, and he also enjoined the NSA from collecting any more information on Larry Klayman, the guy who brought the lawsuit, and then he unenjoined his own enjoinment, or whatever you call it. Right?
He unenjoined his own enjoyment. He kind of had to do that,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Right. Nevertheless, he did it.
So this is probably going to end up at the D.C. Circuit, right?
I think it's going to end up at the D.C. Circuit. Oh, golly. Three new judges on the D.C. Circuit.
But they're Obama appointees, and so if they're loyal to Obama and Obama likes this program,
exactly.
Does that matter? I don't know.
You never know which way judges are going to jump on something like this.
Especially judges with lifetime appointments.
Judges with a lifetime appointments, and judges tend to just display this astonishing independence once they get onto a court.
Yeah, which is how it's supposed to work.
We don't know what they're going to do. Yeah. It was a very interesting. He is a President George W. Bush appointee.
This guy?
This guy.
Oh, very interesting.
Richard Leon, yes.
Well, this is arguably the conservative position, and Larry Klayman is a hyper-conservative, the guy who brought the case.
Hyper.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So he also referred to almost Orwellian technology in his ruling.
Yeah, well, I think that that's probably a reasonable description.
Yeah, so it's a fascinating ruling. It's the first one. Also, there are similar lawsuits in at least three other federal courts around the country. So we'll see which way, once they wend their way, which way the judges jump on those. Because you don't expect judges to be influenced by other judges. But once one judge has broken that dam of actually saying, this is probably unconstitutional, you don't know what other judges are going to do.
Right.
Also, staying with the NSA, the White House said today there's been no change in U.S. policy towards Edward Snowden after a top NSA official suggested on 60 Minutes last night that the administration have a conversation about offering Snowden amnesty in exchange for the return of a cache of top secret documents. Mr. Snowden is charged with a felony, and he should return home to face those charges, where he will be afforded all due process.
Says Jake Carney. I see you're at the White House in the luxury talk radio news suite there in just below the Oval Office.
Yes, we had our basement party today.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, basement party is a big deal.
All the different, this is because all the different news agencies have a little cubby like you do underneath the White House that they broadcast from?
Yes, and so the upstairs doesn't have a party, interestingly enough. Only the basement has a party.
Huh.
And we invite Carney and Josh Earnest and the other people from the press. We allow them to come, and one of our people writes a parody on Twas the Night Before Christmas.
Oh, isn't that cute?
It's quite funny, actually. I'll send you a copy of it.
I would love to see it.
Also, the House passed budget deal is expected to advance in the Senate tomorrow, but it could be a close vote due to significant Republican opposition. They are gaining some Republicans. Orrin Hatch looks like he's a yes vote. Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont. We don't know which way he's going to jump on this. He could be a no because he's really ticked off that unemployment insurance has not been extended, but he could be a yes.
Yeah, I my sense of it, and I don't want to speak for Bernie or characterize him. He talked about that at some length on this program on Friday.
Yes.
And my guess of how he would behave is that he would not be the obstructionist. In other words, if his vote becomes the vote that's going to cause it to pass or fail, that he would probably vote to pass it. But that if it's not the vote that's going to cause it to fail, he would probably cast a no vote as a symbol of his disapproval. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes, that makes total sense.
I mean, it's very commonly done in the political world. And that would just be my guess. I got no special insights, and I've had no conversation with him other than the one that we had on the air in front of all of our listeners.
Well, that's pretty close.
Yeah, but
it's pretty close. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi spoke out against the Obama administration's pace of deportations in a not-too-well-noticed interview over the weekend with Telemundo, saying she's seen deportations that were totally unjustified in San Francisco, saying our view of the law is if somebody's here without sufficient documentation, that is not reason for deportation. If someone's broken the law or committed a felony or something, that's a different story.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with this. My niece fell in love with the local guy who owned the local Mexican restaurant and got married to him, and they had a baby, and then discovered that he was not a legal U.S. citizen. He's Mexican, and they are now living in Mexico with their three children.
Wow. Can they come back?
They cannot.
If the law's changed?
Oh, if the law changes, yeah. But, I mean, you know, it's mind-boggling. You know, she and all her kids are U.S. citizens, but he's not, And they literally had to flee. I mean, it's bizarre.
That's
bizarre. In my own family, I mean, it's like, and I have to believe that more and more families have stories like that. And my family's not Hispanic. I mean, you know, but more and more families that are not Hispanic have these kinds of stories, and that's got to be pushing this thing too.
Well, immigrant groups say about 1,100 undocumented immigrants are deported every day.
That's incredible. That's just incredible. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goes for the old goat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
And give my best to the basement.
Give my best to the kitten.
I'll swap you pictures. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, the Declaration of Independence was the first founding document of any country at any time in the history of the world to specifically mention this one magic word. Happiness. Thomas Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." For hundreds of years, we have stood by this idea that hard work and perseverance, right opportunities, anyone can be happy in America and achieve the American dream. But today, the American dream is on life support. Happiness is like, it's vanishing. Arthur Brooks points out in the New York Times, according to new research, Arthur Brooks, by the way, of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, according to new research, one of the major variables under our control when it comes to overall happiness is happiness at work. And a 2012 study by researchers at Stanford University found that being happy is nearly impossible if you don't have work, if you're unemployed. And money aside, unemployment increases the rates of divorce and suicide. Because people are not happy. In fact, being employed is so important to Americans that according to University of Chicago's General Social Survey, this is a survey that they've been doing for, I think, 27 years, every other year, 3/4 of Americans wouldn't quit their jobs even if they had a sudden financial windfall. Now, to be happy at work, you got to have a job. And right now, about 11 million Americans don't have a job. They want one, but they don't have one. FDR once said that happiness lies not in the mere possession of money. It lies in the joy of achievement and the thrill of creative effort. But that joy of achievement has been wiped out. 32 years of Reaganomics, decades of insane trade policies that have shipped millions of good-paying American jobs overseas, crippling austerity measures. Right, this is the new Republican thing. It used to be trickle-down economics. You know, let's cut taxes for the rich and everybody, okay, that didn't work. What are we going to do now? Oh, austerity. Let's lay off 700,000 government employees. Plus a genuine and general unwillingness by the government to be considered the employer of last resort. According to the Economic Policy Institute, when NAFTA was signed into law by Bill Clinton in 1994, the sales pitch that we were given by both Republicans and Democrats, keep in mind George Herbert Walker Bush was as in favor of this as was Bill Clinton. It was Ross Perot who said, oh, no, wait a minute. It was supposed to create 200,000 new jobs. But instead, as of 2010, the last year that we have numbers for, thanks to growing trade deficits with Mexico, NAFTA has eliminated over 680,000 American jobs. In 2010, when President Obama signed the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, the Obama administration said that this is going to create 70,000 American jobs. Right. Not so much. As EPI points out, in 2011, the U.S. trade deficit with South Korea increased by $5 billion, which translates into 40,000 U.S. jobs. Gone from here, popping up in Korea. But meanwhile, as these so-called free trade agreements are wiping out American jobs in the private sector, austerity is slashing jobs in the public sector, in the government sector. Since June of 2009, because of Republican-pushed austerity measures, 740,000 Americans have lost their jobs. People who worked for various government agencies. 750,000. And that's just in the last 4 years. And what's keeping many of these Americans unemployed are conservatives in Washington who refuse to acknowledge that when capitalism fails, the government should be the employer of last resort. Back in 1944, FDR released his so-called Economic Bill of Rights, and one of those rights was the right to a useful and remunerative job. But conservatives in Washington don't see it FDR's way, and instead love a phony argument over the size of government, which has been shrinking, by the way. From job-killing trade policies and devastating austerity measures to the government's refusal to be the employer of last resort, America has lost millions of jobs. And if you get your happiness from your job, millions of Americans have lost the American dream. There's no way we can be a happy nation again without getting those jobs back and making sure that all Americans have an equal shot at a good job. It's time to close the book on Reaganomics, toss austerity aside, keep good jobs in America, and make our government the employer of last resort by creating the modern equivalent of the WPA and the CCC. Only if we do that will Americans really have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Seriously. I got this. Come on, open. There we go. This FDR clip. I got a private enterprise, indeed, became too private. Right? This is Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1936. I'm pretty sure this is it. You got me? Got my computer up, Shane?
Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise.
There you go. And, you know, we're there again, right? The robber barons are back. This is exactly what FDR was describing. In fact, he went on to talk basically about, you know, Alec and the Koch brothers saying, you know, your right to a job. Well, here, I'll let FDR say it. He says it so much better than I do.
The royalists I have spoken of, the royalists of the economic order, have conceded that political freedom was the business of the government, but they have maintained that economic slavery was nobody's business.
Don't you love it? Economic slavery? Come on, President Obama, listen to your predecessors.
They granted that the government could protect the citizen in his right to vote, but they denied that the government could do anything to protect the citizen in his right to work and his right to live.
There you go. See? And by the way, now the modern economic royalists, the billionaires who are funding the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, who is promulgating all these rules and laws and things, these voter suppression and voter ID laws and all this kind of thing, they don't even acknowledge that you have a right to vote. I mean, FDR back in 1936 would say, you know, these economic royalists at least acknowledge that you have a right to vote. Not anymore. Not anymore. If you're trying to vote in Texas with a concealed carry permit as your only form of ID, no problem. Because that's something mostly white males have. But if you're trying to vote with a student ID issued by a college, issued by a state university, where you have to prove your identity to get in, you can't vote. That's that state university issued ID. No. Why? Because young people in college are more likely to vote for Democrats. I mean, this is how bad it's gotten. We now not only have the economic royalists that FDR had, inequality literally is where it was in 1929. As Robert Reich points out in that brilliant new movie that he's got, Inequality for All. But the economic royalists are even more in our face than they were then.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's time for us to do something about this. And the next big opportunity is the election coming up in November. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And my mouse is not working. Ah, there we go. Sue in Morgan, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Sue, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First of all, if you're going to donate your brain to science, may I have a slice, please?
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I agree with everything you're saying about FDR, but I'm really ticked about the discussion about President Obama being a black man. He's not a black man. He's a biracial man. His black father did not nurture him, raise him, support him, educate him. His Caucasian mother and Caucasian grandmother did. And so not only are we talking about race discrimination, we're talking about gender discrimination every time we call President Obama a black man. There's only one race, the human race. There's nothing else. And we all are human, male, female, regardless of color. And I'm so tired of it. He should be called President Obama. It should be called the Affordable Care Act. He should not be disrespected. His wife should not be disrespected. His mother and his grandmother should not be disrespected. And we need to insist upon this.
Yeah. I don't disagree. I don't disagree.
Thank you. I mean, I have brothers, sisters, nieces, and nephews who are biracial. My family adopted biracial. Mm-hmm. And I'm just so sick of it.
Well, what it's a symptom of is this... I mean, probably a large proportion of, quote, African-Americans carry some portion, and in some cases some very large portions, of, quote, white blood. And, you know, what this all boils down to is, you know, Joe Madison made this comment to me the other night. He said, you know, the only thing that separates us is a little bit of skin pigment, melanin, you know, this chemical on our skin.
Yeah.
Skin. And
right.
You know, otherwise we're all people here. We all have the same desires. We all have the same wants. We all, you know, we all want the best for our kids. We all want a decent job. We all, you know, we all want to live in a safe and meaningful society and have a good life. But there are these racists who say that, you know, even some small contaminating drop, you know, of African-American blood, it's a real sad commentary on, A, where these folks are coming from right now, but B, on the legacy of slavery in the United States, the legacy of racism in the United States, and on the ongoing mindset that we find in the South. It's Yeah, I don't know how to say it beyond that. It's just, you know, you look at the South, and where racism is still so intense, and you know, now South Carolina, I believe it is, or is it North Carolina, just passed one of the Carolinas just passed the most restrictive voter laws. North Carolina, yeah, where Art Pope is doing his thing. Yeah, North Carolina. Anyhow, Sue, thank you for the call. Excellent point. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
Apply to us the label liberal. If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with the taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal.
This is JFK.
But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties.
Those are their jobs.
Someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad. If that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
There you go. John Kennedy, I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal. Indeed. Mary in Wallingford, Connecticut. Hey, Mary, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, I finally got through to you, Tom. Yes, when you were discussing 11 million jobs, or 11 million people that are unemployed.
Right, and that's the lowest estimate. That's the official U6 number, I think it is, or whatever. If you look at underemployed, it's really closer to 20 million.
Yeah, it doesn't take, I believe you on that. It doesn't take much to understand that the people that have finally run out of unemployment may still be out of work too, correct?
Exactly.
Okay, so we also have people that have found work and they're working for far less. Then we have millions that are working at minimum wage. How bad is it going to get to where our own government cannot generate enough federal tax revenues from all the jobs they've let go to Pacific Rim countries?
Well, this is a serious problem. When we came out of World War II, our debt, our national debt, stood at 127% of GDP. I mean, right now it's just topped over 100% of GDP. And Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower did not engage in any kind of austerity whatsoever to get us out of that. Instead, they went on a federal spending binge. Dwight Eisenhower built the national highway system. He built schools from coast to coast. Harry Truman did the GI Bill and sent young people coming back from the military to college for 4 years, paid them a stipend to go to college. My dad, my wife's dad, both paid a stipend to go to college. Truman put into place, and then Eisenhower actually expanded the GI home loans. My dad was able to buy a house with a 3% mortgage, fixed rate, 30-year, or 20, maybe it was 20 years, whatever it was. It was all this stuff. Basically, they said, we're going to throw government at this problem of a national debt. And within 15 years, that national debt was pretty much resolved. I mean, we were down to 40-50% of GDP as the national debt, which is where you actually want it to be. You have to have a certain amount of national debt because people want to invest in treasuries. So, because government debt is the private savings.
Now, just talking to friends, to neighbors, to families, even to my own physician, we're losing our sovereignty. We have no control over what they're doing.
That's right.
How do we get that control back? How do we demand the individual person to make those changes? They had the Occupy movement, and that fizzled out.
Yeah.
Because it's so hard to get 20 million people together to make change.
I think that the way that we do it is we have to take money out of politics. And, you know, there was a good effort bipartisan. John McCain and Russ Feingold came together and passed McCain-Feingold to get money out of politics. there have been a number of good efforts over the years. Both Republicans and Democrats hate the fact that they have to spend anywhere from 40 to 60% of every single day dialing for dollars and begging people for money, and that they have to go to fundraisers four or five nights a week, again, to raise money. They hate this. They absolutely hate it. And they would love it if they could simply pass a law that said that, you know, and Republicans as well. You know, there are some Republicans who oppose this because they like, you know, being the wholly owned property of the Koch brothers. But the average Republican and certainly all the Democrats would love to get rid of this. But it's the Supreme Court has invented these two doctrines that never have been proposed by any president. In fact, I can give you quotes from presidents who have come right out and said this is wrong. And number one. And have never been proposed by any legislatures. The one presidential candidate who actually said it was a good thing was Mitt Romney. He said, you know, corporations are people, my friends. But that's it. That's it. No president has ever said it. And no legislature has ever said that corporations should have protections under the 14th Amendment or that money should have protection under the First Amendment. Nobody. Zero. Zip. But because we live in this constitutional monarchy where the Supreme Courts have appointed themselves monarchs, they have more power than the kings and queens of other countries, of the European countries. They have created this doctrine out of whole cloth. They invented it literally back in the middle of the 19th century, and they brought it to fruition in 2010 with Citizens United. And this has to be undone. And the only way I know of to do that is to amend the Constitution to say corporations are not people and money is not speech. And the best organization out there doing that work right now is movetoamend.org. And so if you want to solve the problem that you're identifying, Mary, first we have to get money out of politics so our politicians represent us rather than the billionaires. And to do that, we need, and Move to Amend has gotten over 500 communities across the United States and over 20 states to pass non-binding resolutions in support of this. We need to call an Article 5 constitutional convention, in essence. We need to propose this constitutional amendment to say corporations aren't people and money is not speech. Go to movetoamend.org. You can start a local chapter in your kitchen. I mean, you can do it in your living room. You can start it out of your home, or you can find a local chapter near you and sign up and participate. And I've got nothing to do with this organization, by the way, other than I'm just so impressed by the work that they're doing and so, you know, blown away by the good work that David Cobb and these folks do at movetoamend.org. So
yeah,
that's,
we appreciate your doing that.
That's
you know,
my
getting the word out is important.
Yeah, and so now tag you're it, Mary. If you can tell five people about movetoamend.org and get, you know, some people involved in this. And there are other organizations out there that are trying to amend the Constitution as well or who are doing the same thing, although a lot of them are doing it in sort of a half-baked way. You know, they're saying, well, let's just roll back Citizens United. Sorry, rolling back Citizens United isn't enough. We need to declare absolutely, unambiguously, corporations are not people and money is not speech. Mary, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And only then, when the Supreme Court invented fiction of money in corporations, only then can we have a democracy. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, while we're listening to past presidents, you know, it's always interesting to have a little context, right? To put things in context, to have an understanding of history. Jimmy Carter, during the Bush presidency, during the most recent Bush presidency, Jimmy Carter was on the Today Show talking about the war in Iraq. Here's what he had to say. I find this fascinating.
And so it wasn't 9/11 that precipitated the attack. This was the culmination of a long-term plan. We're going to attack Iraq. We're going to establish an American military base of a major character in the Middle East, in Iraq, and in the process remove Saddam Hussein. And I think that the claims that Saddam was involved in 9/11 and the claims that they had massive weapons of mass destruction that would threaten our country were manipulated, at least, to mislead the American people into going
to war. Yeah. Manipulated, you think? But this is the one that I really love. This is back in 1940. Must be 1940, right? The presidential elections are years that end with zero, even years that end with zero. So 1900, 1920, 1940, 1960, 1980, 2000. Those were presidential election years. So this is 1940 In 1940, Ronald Reagan was a Democrat. Okay? And keep in mind, 1940, and oh, wait a minute, this is an ad for Truman. So this must have been 1948. Yeah, because Truman ran for president in 48. So this is 48. This was after World War II. This is an ad for Harry Truman and Hubert Humphrey. Hubert Humphrey was running for the United States Senate from Minnesota. That was done by Ronald Reagan when he was a Democrat. And it's actually a damn good ad. So listen to this.
The profits of corporations have doubled, while workers' wages have increased by only one quarter. In other words, profits have gone up four times as much as wages.
Sound familiar?
And the small increase workers did receive was more than eaten up by rising prices, which have also bored into their savings. For example, here's an Associated Press dispatch I read the other day about Smith L. Carpenter, a craftsman in Union Springs, New York. Seems that Mr. Carpenter retired some years ago, thinking he had enough money saved up so that he could live out his last years without having to worry. But he didn't figure on this Republican inflation, which ate up all his savings, and so he's gone back to work. The reason this is news is Mr. Carpenter is 91 years old. Now, take as a contrast the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which reported a net profit of $210 million after taxes for the first half of 1948, an increase of 70% in 1 year. In other words, high prices have not been caused by higher wages, but by bigger and bigger profits. The Republican promises sounded pretty good in 1946, but what has happened since then, since the 80th Congress took over? Prices have climbed to the highest level in history, although the death of the OPA was supposed to bring prices down through, quote, the natural process of free competition, unquote. Labor has been handcuffed by the vicious Taft-Hartley law. Social Security benefits have been snatched away from almost a million workers by the Gearhart bill. Fair employment practices, which had worked so well during wartime, have been abandoned. Veterans' pleas for low-cost homes have been ignored. And many people are still living in made-over chicken coops and garages. Tax reduction bills have been passed to benefit the higher income brackets alone. The average worker saved only $1.73 a week. In the false name of economy, millions of children have been deprived of milk once provided through the federal school lunch program. This was the payoff of the Republicans' promises. And this is why we must have new faces in the Congress of the United States, Democratic faces. This is why we must elect not only President Truman, but also men like Mayor Hubert Humphrey of Minneapolis, the Democratic candidate for senator from Minnesota.
There you go. Yeah, it's incredible. That was the Congress that he was speaking of, by the way, was, you know, the Republicans from 1932 until the middle of the Clinton presidency. I forget which year. I think it was 96. But for that entire period, for that, like what would that be, 40, 50 years, something like that, during that entire period, there was only 2 years when the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives, and that was 46, 47. And that was the Congress that Ronald Reagan was just attacking, with the Gearhart bill and with Taft-Hartley and this vicious act and this, you know, and all this stuff. That was what the Republicans did. Pretty amazing stuff. So, anyway. Janet in Kathleen, Georgia. Hey, Janet, what's up?
Hi, I was calling in response to your previous guest, Mr. McCabe, and as well as to some comments by Wayne LaPierre and Gun Owners of America, mm-hmm. others of that ilk. I was calling about an incident we had down here in Georgia back in August of this school year, and we had a gunman armed with an AK-47 and 500 rounds went into a school in Decatur, Georgia, and the bookkeeper talked him down. So clearly the response to a bad guy with a gun is a good woman without a gun.
Yeah, apparently. Apparently. I remember when that happened, and you're absolutely right. Janet, thank you for calling and sharing that. That was an excellent story. Donald in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Donald, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hi, Tom. Yeah, I was listening to about this situation with Citizens United. I remember when President Obama was warning them of the consequences of what they were putting through, and I think his Alito was mouthing was mouthing the word no.
That's right.
He was.
It was during the State of the Union address in 2011. Yeah.
Well, the thing, you know, what really kills me about this whole thing is, now, you mentioned about this one organization that moved to amend.org.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's going to do anything, to be honest with you. I think that we gotta somehow get back to the Supreme Court. These people are going to be in there until the day they die. Yeah. And I know you're against...
Here's the problem, though. Even if the Democrats take control of the Supreme Court, you know, if God forbid, I'm not wishing this on any of them, but if one of the five right-wing justices, one of the five Republican appointees were to die or to just decide to retire, actually, and President Obama was to replace them with a liberal, that there is still so much precedent. I mean, this goes back to Dartmouth in 1815. It goes back to Southern Pacific Railroad versus Santa Clara County in 1886. It goes back to some of the slaughterhouse cases. There has been a whole series. There's been over 35 Supreme Court decisions in which corporate personhood is mentioned directly or indirectly that lead up to Citizens United. They're not going to reverse it. We need to reverse it. And here's the thing, if I can, you know, respectfully share this with you, and then you can come back at me telling me, you know, how wrong I am. But the amendment, this is how fast things can happen. You know, because people say, oh, a constitutional amendment. There have been 29,000 constitutional amendments offered since 1791, and there's only a total of 27 constitutional amendments that have ever passed, right? But the 26th, which gave 18-year-olds the right to vote, was passed during a time when there was a broad consensus in America. Barry McGuire's song, Eve of Destruction, had just come out, and you know, you're old enough to kill but not for voting. Everybody was singing this song. The 26th Amendment was proposed on March 23rd, 1971. Guess when it was ratified?
When?
July 1st, 1971. So
yeah.
it was proposed on March 23rd of 71, and it took April, May, June for it to pass the two-thirds of the Senate and three-quarters of the states.
Well, that's pretty fast, though, right?
That's my point. That's my point. When the people have their dander up, you know, this stuff can happen really fast. I mean, it's the same thing, for example, I'm looking for repeal of prohibition. Yeah, here we go. Repeal of prohibition, the 21st Amendment, was proposed on February 20th, 1933. It was ratified on December 5th, 1933. That took 11 months. So it's like, you know, when you've got the majority of the American people on your side, and the majority of the American people do not think that corporations should be people, and they do not think that money should be speech.
I know, and they didn't like guns either. Look what happened, 90% of them. And the truth of the matter is, I know you're against term limits, but the thing is, that's the only leverage we're going to have.
No, what term limits will make things worse, Donald, because what term limits do is they make the permanent institutions around government, the institution to whom the newbies turn for advice on how do I get things done around here, they turn that into the lobbyists.
Well,
you know, Jefferson spent his entire life in government. George Washington spent most of his life in government. Adams spent his entire life in government. His son, John Quincy Adams, you know, James Monroe spent his life in government. There's nothing wrong with being a statesman your entire life.
There's nothing wrong with it when you got people that are in the that have their best interest in the American people. These people here are locking themselves into positions where we can't get them out. They're gerrymandering the districts. They're suppressing the voting. They're putting in emergency managers that could discredit anybody that you select. Our whole voting system's going down the toilet. I don't know how we're going to get these people out.
We get it out by getting the money out, Donald. When you've got the money out of politics, then you don't have the voting machine companies lobbying Congress to privatize our vote. You don't have the private prison corporations lobbying Congress to extend the drug law war any longer. You don't, I mean, you know, basically, the members of Congress will become responsible only to one constituency, which is you and me, if we can get the money out of politics. And the only way to get the money out of politics is to strike down these Supreme Court rulings that have been going on for a century and a half. And the only way to do that is to amend the Constitution. Move to amend.org. Donald, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'll bet their ears are burning over there. It's move to amend.org. as in Move to Amend the Constitution, movetoamend.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ed watching freespeechtv.org in Jackson, Tennessee. Hey, Ed, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
Hey, I told you, Screener, I was going to talk about the what racism causes, but I want to ask you this, and then I'll go to that if you got time. Why is $750 billion that's wasted in our health care? Have you seen that study?
No.
30 cents of every dollar is wasted.
Oh, well, 20 cents of every dollar goes to the health insurance companies, you know, when Medicare runs on 3%.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think 30% has got to be a conservative number, because you got 20% going to the health insurance companies. I consider all of that to be waste, and or at least 17% of it. And then you've got, you know, the for-profit hospitals, the for-profit pharmaceutical companies, all the middlemen, all the hustling, all the TV ads. I mean, it's just, you know, who's paying for those drug company TV ads that you see on TV every night where they say, you know, may cause death and, you know, call your doctor if your erection lasts more than 4 hours. You're paying for that with higher drug prices. So I think that 30% is a very conservative number, given the fact that we pay just about exactly twice as much as any other industrialized country in the world, and about 60% more than the average of the 34 richest countries in the world. I would guess that at least 50% of healthcare spending is waste.
Well, here's the other topic. Racism literally cost America $2 trillion a year, ready to stop payment. And I told your call screener, this is, I saw it on Yahoo, but the let's see, complete accounting of the toll taken by race-based chauvinism has arisen in the form of a W.K. Kellogg Foundation study, but almost $2 trillion. It's the business case for racial equity.
Is this the cost of discrimination of people not engaging in the workforce because the workforce isn't there for them, the loss of taxpayers out of the middle class?
I didn't download the Kellogg thing, but it says here, let's see, it was conducted by the Institute of Johns Hopkins, Brandeis, Harvard Universities, and demonstrates how race, class, residential segregation, and income levels all work together to hamper access to opportunity. And then, of course, it talks about the incarceration. And also, Tom, you can look that up, you would, about the racism. But
sure.
Another thing I hear a lot of people say, you know, when LBJ started the war on poverty, and everybody says, well, it didn't work. To me, the whole reason it didn't work is the war on drugs.
Well, the war on poverty actually cut the poverty rate in the United States from 26% down to 13% over the course of the following six or seven years. He cut poverty in half in the United States. So it did work. And it created a black middle class that, by and large, didn't exist before that.
Right. But then the war on drugs came on, and they've been devastated ever since.
Yeah, and black and white. It's just different drugs in the different communities, whether it's crack cocaine or whether it's meth.
Blacks, definitely blacks have been wiped out.
Yeah, well, and because of all these years of racism, you know, the people at the bottom always get crushed the first. They're the most fragile. Their culture is the most fragile. Their lifestyles are the most fragile. Absolutely. And it's something we should do something about. We haven't, you know, Ed, we have not, Lyndon Johnson, when he declared the war on poverty, talked about ending poverty in America. Now we just talk about containing it, reducing it. We haven't had a serious conversation in this country, literally in 60 years, or 50 years, about ending poverty in the United States, and we need to. Ed, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Trooper in Kremlin, Colorado. Hey, Trooper, what's up?
Hey, not much. It's awesome to be on your show. Great, huge fan. Anyway, I wanted to say that, you know, I hear from my conservative-leaning friends that government is out of control. And from my point of view, I understand how they feel that way, but I think that it's not out of control. It's out of our control. It's well under the control of large corporations.
Yes. And the banksters. Yes. Excellent point.
Yes.
Excellent point.
Absolutely.
And again, this has to do with money and politics. Go to movetoamend.org.
Yes.
I mean, it's like that's the original sin. That's the cancer at the core of our society. Trooper, thank you. Excellent point. George in Glendale, Arizona. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, you had a question about what brought on the First World War.
Right.
Yeah, well, the historian William L. Sherry had a book, The Collapse of the Third Republic, An Inquiry into the Fall of France. And he talked about imperial empire and land grabbing. He said in 1905, Kaiser Wilhelm was impetuous, and his chancellor, Prince von Bülow, landed at Tangier. Wilhelm warned Morocco to remain an independent state, and all powers have equal commercial opportunities in Morocco. Germany would not go along with France gaining control in Morocco. So France, ill-prepared for war, because of reduction of its military service from 3 to 2 years, they had a small army, while Kaiser was ginning up for war because they had a very powerful army.
Right.
War and conquest are biological necessities, and France must be crushed, is what the information media in Germany was talking about.
Hmm.
In 1911, new crisis developed in Morocco. German gunboat Panther put into the Moroccan port of Agadir to protect German interests. But it was there just to intimidate France. France occupied Fez at the time, and by the request of the Sultan, was fighting a civil war, and he was under siege at the time. The French gave the Germans two large slices of the French Congo to appease them and avert a Franco-German war. This guy, which is Calais, Premier of France, said that they would give Germany access to the colonial territories, better collaboration in Europe. And he was trying to appease Wilhelm, but Wilhelm balked at the offer. Germany had a strong navy and army and felt invincible. In 1914, three assassinations occurred. One was where Calais' wife killed Gaston Clement, editor of Le Figaro, Le Figaro was blasting her husband's policies. Then in July, Giraud assassinated by a right-wing fanatic. These fellows had dominated the French Parliament, and they had the two largest parties in France were working for peace. But then in June of the 28th of 1914, Archduke Francis Ferdinand, of course we know that heir to the Habsburg throne, was slain by a Serbian fanatic in Sarajevo.
He wasn't a fanatic, he was a nationalist.
What's that?
He wasn't you can call him a fanatic, but he was a Serbian nationalist. He wanted independence for Serbia.
Said. I'm just paraphrasing what he said.
Yeah.
And then that's what sparked the First World War, and the Austrian-Hungarian Empire was crumbling anyway.
Right.
And then Germany tried to get the blessing of England to march into Belgium, and they were trying to prod France to give up their forts in Toul and Verdun. And, of course, the English ambassador was in Germany at the time, and the German ambassador said, because you had just a scrap of paper, are you going to start a war? And he tried to throw the blame on England.
Right. So to bring this to today, this piece that was in the New York Times over this last weekend, the piece that Gideon Rockman wrote in the Financial Times back on February 4th of this year, where they're both saying the echoes of 1911 to 1914 are sounding today, only now they're sounding in the Pacific and in the Middle East. Gideon Rockman in particular saying, could the Middle East be the next, the next Sarajevo? And now this whoever wrote this piece for the Washington Post saying, where did it go? Anyhow, saying essentially Margaret Macmillan, could these islands off the coast of Japan be the next Sarajevo?
Well, most of it we're talking about anyway is imperial empire and land grabbing. That's been around forever,
Right, but that's what's going on right now between Japan and China is they're contesting these islands, and it appears that there's some oil there, and it appears that there may be other minerals there, plus there's shipping lanes, and there's all kinds of stuff like that. And so the question then becomes, are we just being too cavalier about this? Are we not taking this too seriously? Because China is building their navy in a way that they're building their navy. They are arming almost as rapidly as we were during World War II. I mean, they are just, well, not probably not that fast, but they are arming more rapidly than anything that we've seen since 1913, 1914, with Germany and Britain.
Yeah, and they're stealing the water out of the Great Lakes.
The Chinese?
Sure, they're taking it. Nestle Corporation is involved in a lot of that, too, where they're taking loads and loads of barges of water out of the Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, off the tributaries because they can't take it right out of the lake. See, they think that water is going to be the most important commodity, which it will in the future.
Yeah, you're already seeing water wars around the world. I think it's interesting that London has privatized their water supply. I mean, this stuff is happening all over the place. George, thanks a lot for the call. John, Charles, Carol, Claude, Dorothy, Gary, Carlos, Joe. Sorry we didn't get to your calls. We will tomorrow. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have all the news and information you won't hear on the corporate-owned news media, along with your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. So get over there to movetoamend.org or pdamerica.org and sign up. Occupy something. Right? Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.